This is a continuation of the interview with Ruben Lorenz. It is now Tuesday, the 23rd of October, and we are talking again in his office in the credit union.
The remark you just made to me seems like a good beginning for this section of the interview on the 1960s. I said that you were busy. You seem to be very busy. I was commenting on the number of boxes you have in the archives. And you said it was a constructive kind of busyness.
The 60s was a period of growth for not only for the University of Wisconsin, but for most higher education around the country. We had that big explosion of federal support, which continued as a follow-up to the Sputnik event. And so the federal government poured hundreds of millions of dollars into fellowships in science and engineering particularly. Along with that, of course, the federal government also put a tremendous amount of money into facilities, both into the science and engineering, medical-related facilities, and even they had a lot of the other title programs which provided funding for the two-year campuses in the system. Every one of those had additions during that period, and they all had federal support to the municipalities. See, the centers were not built by the university. They were all built by the local, usually the counties, built the facilities, and the university bought the equipment for them. And in order for us to get federal aid on it, we had to sign an agreement that we'd put on an educational program to be used for educational purposes for extended periods of time. But the federal government put an awful lot of money into those areas. So it wasn't strictly limited to the science and engineering. In fact, there's a fair amount of federal money in Van Hise Hall. And it's administration, so I suppose you could say it has a connection with science and engineering, but basically it wasn't for that purpose. Then also that was the same time that the enrollments were growing rapidly, and not only were they growing during that time, but the future enrollment estimates, which were prepared during the 60s, were very rosy pictures for the future of higher education. So the state was willing to go along and put a lot of additional money into higher education as well. The 60s, up until the Vietnam situation really came to a crisis, were great years for higher education, and Wisconsin participated very heavily in that growth and the glory years, as you might say. And I think that we were fortunate in retaining a lot of our top faculty during that period. We lost some very good ones. I remember when Van Tamelen and Bill Johnson went to Stanford within a year of each other, two really outstanding scientists in chemistry. And I think that was in the 60s when they left. But by and large, we did retain a lot of our very good people and were able to recruit good young people that since then have developed into good scientists.
You had been living in the Fred administration when not much was being done. The university was beginning to grow. There weren't many buildings. Did you feel any alarm or sense that it was going too fast in the 60s when this began?
Well, I guess one of the areas, one of the few areas where we felt that we were doing something which we probably shouldn't have been doing at the time was the building of the dormitories at Milwaukee. Milwaukee, you know, is relatively new in the system. It came in I believe 56 is when it became part of the University of Wisconsin. Fred Harrington and Joe Clatchy pretty much agreed that they were going to have dormitories for a substantial number of their students to start with, about 10% of their enrollment estimates of 25,000. So they wanted dormitories on campus. Now, it's a very small campus. It's only 96 acres, the whole campus is. So it's very compact. So they had to be high-rise dormitories. And we just didn't see the market for that.
In the business office.
Right. They were built anyway, and of course they were not occupied until just well, I guess this is the first year that, in fact, I think even this year there are some other offices in the building, but there wasn't a demand for outside students to come to Milwaukee campus and live on campus. But beyond that, most of the expansion made a lot of sense. There were some ideas which Fred Harrington brought forward at different times, which never materialized, and it was a good thing they didn't materialize, because, well, there just aren't enough students in the state to fill them. We had the one idea was to have a campus on the base of Picnic Point. Another one to have basically a separate campus out on the Reeder Farm, which could have been a freshman, sophomore campus or an undergraduate. It never really got to a final concept stage or anything like that. And another one was to have one where the hospital now is in the west end of the campus, and various mixtures of multi-campus situations in the Madison area. He also wanted to, I think his goal was to have residence halls for as high as 50% of the students on the Madison campus. You know, it was, historically, it was running closer. Well, at that time, I suppose it was with the Southeast Dormitory, which were in the planning stage, at least. Madison has almost 7,000 students in single-family housing, and at that time, there was around 20,000 students, probably, so it was about third, but there were plans where those big parking lots are off University Avenue now, and that whole area just west of University Square, that shopping center, and so on.
Yes.
See, that was all scheduled too for student housing, and some of that was for apartments and this type of thing. But that whole area in there was all scheduled for student housing. There were a number of blocks more that were at one time proposed, and there was also going to be some student housing out where the new Bet Science Building is, in that area or there or where the farms are, and so. Not plugging here. Good morning. Yeah. Where?
Ideas.
Yeah, they were. You know, he had he was an idea person. There's no question about it that he was a great thinker and an aggressive person.
Did you actually deal with him? Were you in on the meetings?
I was in on quite a few of the meetings. Yes, and I sat
early.
In. Sat in on quite a few while he was president. I sat in a lot of them.
But, I mean, was there the regular? Did he have cabinet meetings, or whatever he would have called them?
I don't recall a regularly scheduled cabinet meetings that we met on an ongoing basis like we have the last 7, 8, 9 years. We met every Monday we'd meet as a cabinet, but I think he met more with Clodius. And Clodius was his vice president for a good share of the term, and I think the two of them met quite a bit together. Then when Peterson died,
So you admired him?
Oh yes.
You found him rash, or? How would you describe your what was your how did you feel about him?
As president, he wasn't the easiest person to work with because he wasn't a warm individual, you know, that you could really relate to easily. Especially, I didn't have the academic credentials and so on that other people may have, and so on. And he was not a particularly warm person, but I certainly admired his brilliance. It was really something, and still is. You know, he's just a brilliant. has a brilliant mind and the smartest person I ever knew. Also admired him for ideas. And several times, I know, we went to meetings where you'd brief him just a little bit, you know, on the salient facts and some issue. And all he needed was a few facts, and he could go on and explain the entire operation. So it was enjoyable to work with somebody like that. Bright and much of an intellectual, and can articulate as well as he could. He was a very articulate person. He did have some problems in that respect. That was both physically and intellectually. He would talk down to people sometimes, and that was one thing that got him into trouble. With other people, that kept him from being as continually effective as he should have been, and as would have been deserving. And a lot of people thought he had a couple other things. That I guess that people thought he was over aggressive. He was a real builder, and of course he. I always feel that you're better off to have somebody that's over-aggressive, that you have to have a few reins on to hold them in check, rather than somebody who doesn't come up with any ideas. So that doesn't really bother me any. And the other one is that his tendency to kind of talk down to people in some ways, because he was an egghead in their mind and this type of thing.
Would he talk down to somebody like you or Cafferty? Or
oh, no, never to people in the staff, never
so
that
this
one.
But
sometimes, you know, you'd get into a question and answer period at a legislative hearing or at a board meeting and so on, and the people knew they couldn't compete with him intellectually, and it would come through, not direct, not point blank. He wasn't doing it intentionally.
Yeah.
But you know, it would make them feel that their question was a stupid question, because the way he answered it, this type of thing. And you know, he and Jim Nellon didn't really see eye to eye. Jim Nellon didn't.
That's a regent, isn't it?
He was the regent from Green Bay, Dr. Nellon. Was a Packers physician for years, and a former football player in Madison.
Why did they single him out?
Well, I don't know, but they just didn't hit it off, because Nellon was never an intellectual, not the least bit intellectual. And Arthur de Bartleben liked Harrington a great deal.
Yes.
They were good friends, de Bartleben respected the intellectual person. He always had, admiration, or at least respect, for the people, faculty, and the intellectual faculty. I don't think he ever thought that administration was anything but a necessary evil. And he had no qualms at all about ripping through administrators. That was, it didn't bother
DeBartle.
Oh, yeah.
How did he do that?
He's an attorney. And bring something up, and any time, instead of asking a question in a constructive way, it was this: he was cross-examining a witness on the witness stand. And so it was disconcerting to us, and he was particularly, non-appreciative of anybody in the business area. So he was not easy to get along with as far as we're...
Is this at Regents, at the business section?
Well, at the entire board meeting, Actually, he won when de Bartleben was president of the board, which was in the late 60s, as he became a much more effective regent at that time. He was chairman of the board for a number of years. But other than that, you know, when he came back on the board now after merger, too, he got very little support from the other board members because of his attitude and approach. And he could have been such a strong force if only his mannerisms had been a little different, because he was usually right. A very logical mind, and just did an excellent job of synthesizing something and bringing it forward in a very 1, 2, 3, 4 logical manner. As I say, he was usually right in what he took, but he took the position in such a I guess in many cases, offensive manner, that he couldn't get the support of the board to go along with many issues. And many times things would come up and vote would be 14-1 or 15-1 and this type of thing. And he was probably right. So that was an unfortunate situation with his board performance, because he could have been a real, real advocate and strong supporter of the faculty. And that's a necessary thing on the board. It was necessary. But.
Well, you said that it was worse in the beginning. His history, you said he didn't, especially towards the business office, that he didn't respect. Now, is this individuals like Cafferty and Peterson?
Oh, I heard him rip Peterson apart, and he ripped me apart, and this type of thing. I guess I never did hear him tear Cafferty apart,
did he rip you apart about?
Oh, one mine in particular where they hadn't received what he thought was proper notice of some relatively insignificant action item. But he got really just shouting and everything on that one. Remember, he and Ben Lawton got into an argument. It was at a Milwaukee board meeting, and Ben Lawton was, was always very sympathetic to the administration and this type of thing. But in that one, he became almost violent in the discussion on that one. And actually, he and Nellen had some very nasty arguments. And one time at Green Bay, they almost came to blows, I would say, at a board meeting. The closest thing we've ever seen at a board meeting of people really.
What about?
Oh, I don't even remember the issue. It was nothing very important, I'm sure.
What in the things that you were dealing with, do you remember, did he feel most strongly about?
Athletics. We always knew that Arthur would be opposed to anything to spend any money or effort in support of athletics. Athletics was not something that really should have an important place in a major university. And the other issue, not directly related to the business area, but one which we always knew what his position would be anything to do with religion. The state and religion should be completely separated and in all aspects of it, which is a good point.
That can't come up very often.
Well, more often than you'd probably guess, because through certain gifts and bequests and so on may have a religious flavor in it or a religious requirement in it. And another thing with campuses, could they host any religious group on the campus at all? And I'd say a couple times a year there would be some issue related to religion which would come up. But it was always known in advance what position Arthur would be on religion or on athletics. He was consistent.
Uh-huh. Well, I'd expect that.
Yeah.
Those are both pretty peripheral to the
sure.
campus,
yeah.
though.
Yeah.
I mean, was there anything that was happening on the campus in Madison that concerned him or that he was particularly interested in?
Well, he was, as I said, he was such a strong supporter of the faculty. And most any issue which would come forward from the Madison University Committee would receive his wholehearted support. He was just a. If it had gone through the regular faculty channels, then it would generally be completely supported by him, and he would do what he could to get it through the board. And I'm trying to think. Maybe he wasn't on the board during the worst years there of the riots. I'm really not. He must have been though. I can't remember him really taking a strong position at that particular time. And I remember that somebody like Jim Nellen was completely intolerant of the students. And I think this is one of the differences between he and Harrington. Harrington was tolerant towards students. Now, Harrington was a real, and I assume he still is, a real liberal. and he was a strong supporter of student rights, people like Nellen just couldn't see that at all. So I think that was probably the final blow in their relationships, was the fact that Nellen just couldn't understand Harrington's willingness to accept and even to support the student right to object and that type of thing.
Although Harrington was not really in a position to do anything about it.
No, because
but
he was.
Did speak about it.
Well, but he was president at the time, even though Robin Fleming was chancellor of the Madison campus at that time, where the person who was directly involved mm-hmm. with the students, of course. But we used to have demonstrations at every region meeting. They were very nasty, very nasty sessions, looking back on it, I guess we weren't particularly excited about it, because it was just another demonstration, and we'd seen so many of them there in a few years there but members of the Board of Regents coming in from outside, it would be a very traumatic experience for them to have people shout at them and demand and swear at them and stuff like this,
And they would think that Harrington ought to just throw
right.
them out.
That's exactly right. Yeah. That they should be kicked out of school immediately and banned from being on the campus and stuff like that. But
Harrington couldn't have done that because he wasn't in charge of the Madison campus. But they thought he should have told Fleming
that's
the Young.
Exactly. Exactly. That he should have been laying down the law, and he should have been enough in control of the university system to be able to put down, exert the regent position to that extent. And I'm not sure the regents as a board ever really took a position on it, because there was that split on the board, I'm sure DeBart Levin was basically supportive of students, not of course of their riotous behavior, but he was a supporter of student rights, and you also had some faculty in there, that they were also very supportive of the students and helped in some of their presentations. So it was a split on the board.
It must have made it worse, I suppose.
Oh sure. It was a sort of interesting time. Kind of frightful some days, but most of the time it was. Not as disruptive as you would think it would be, because it was usually in a relatively small area of the campus. Engineering campus basically didn't even, the ag campus really didn't have any relationship with most of the demonstrations. Once in a while they get out that far, but usually they were on the other end of the campus.
You would write from Bascom to Van Hise, is that right?
No, I went from the Peterson building.
So you were in Peterson.
I was never in Bascom Hall, no.
Oh.
No.
And Van Hise is in what, 67?
69, I think we moved to. I think it was 69 we moved into Van Hise.
Oh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and see, Cafferty and I never were in Bascom Hall.
I see.
Even after Peterson died. No, he died in 64, I think it was. A.W. Peterson.
Yes.
We never did move our actual business office into Bascom.
What did somebody like Cafferty think of Harrington?
Oh, he liked him. Oh, sure, yeah. He liked him and got along with him fine, yeah. Well, he was such an exciting person to be around, You just couldn't help but like him. Actually, I found Fred Afri left the university and came back. Now he's a much warmer person and more relaxed and everything, so he was. He was so energetic and gung-ho before. I suppose that's one reason he probably gave you the feeling of some coolness. And you'd be talking to him, he was always two sentences ahead of you, and he knew what you were going to say before you ever said it. But I found him now to be much a warmer individual and this type of thing.
I'm really interested in the 60s, but you did work with E.B. Fred Elvian.
Yeah.
Can you say how they were compared to Harrington?
Well, E.B. Fred was always trying to arrive at a consensus. I'm sure a number of ideas which came forward during those years had the genesis of their thinking in his mind and this type of thing, but he would never be a dominating presence at a discussion and this type of thing, because he'd always trying to have everybody speak and trying to arrive at a consensus. And then it would come forward as a consensus. Of course, it's much harder to get things moving in a hurry that way. And those were not real action-oriented days, I guess you would say, because you'd had the big enrollment increase right after the war of the veterans, and then it went way down in like 52 and 53. We had big budget cuts at that time. And then it came back really very slowly for the next 6-7 years while he was president there. So it really wasn't a period of great expansion and this type of thing. And E.B. was an intellectual and a scientist, and he was a very strong supporter of the sciences. And it was during that period when the university really did start to get a lot of extra federal money, even it was before Sputnik, that they were already into the, particularly the health-related, the biochemistry and some of those areas. Not as much in engineering. It really didn't get much money in engineering those days, but we did get money in more of the health-related and, of course, ag-related. So he was such a strong supporter of that. And then Alvium followed him, who was really a working scientist yet when he became president, whereas E.B. Fred had been being dean of the College of Agriculture and dean of graduate school. It had been a long time since he'd really been in the laboratory. But Alvium was still, I think he was still actually working as a scientist while he was president. And of course, nutrition was his big field there. Alvium really wasn't president for very long, a couple of years, I guess.
But you didn't know that. I mean, you people in the administration would assume he was there for a long time before he died suddenly.
Yeah, yeah.
So you had to adjust yourselves to what his policies were going to be.
And he didn't really change things all that much. He was a more or less of a continuation of the Fred type, I think.
Yeah, this is the second side of the tape.
One of the unfortunate things I think of Alvium's administration was, again, as I said, he was pretty much a pure scientist, and found it somewhat difficult to relate to Joint Finance Committee, say, of the legislature. At that time, there were a mixture that was shifting, I guess you would say, from an agricultural-based committee to lawyers and other business people in it. But there was still a fairly strong agricultural influence on it. And he was trying, in some presentations, to be the university president type of thing, and it just didn't go over very well. It didn't. Again, I say his rhetoric and so on was scientifically oriented, and it just didn't go over too well with the Joint Finance Committee. Some of the problems that he had in his administration.
You mean he wasn't able really to express his ideas
in their language?
Yes.
So it was.
He didn't speak English terribly well, isn't that right? Or I guess he didn't write. That was it. Connie Alvium said she had to correct his. Mm-hmm.
You get him in a.
He still had an accent, didn't he?
You get him in a scientific discussion, yeah. and everything flowed very nicely. I think the university presidency was kind of a foreign. Area as far as he was concerned, as far as really going out and selling it to the common person. If he wanted to go to Washington and sell some ideas and nutrition and what was happening in this area, he could be very extremely effective in it, no question about it. He's a very, very excellent scientist. And I didn't work that closely with him in those years. I did some things closely with him, but not I worked more with E.B. Fred, I believe, than I did with Albion, because Albion, I think, worked primarily with A.W. Peterson and Ira Baldwin. And that was basically his cabinet there, and they worked very closely. So.
Did you know Peterson very well?
Well, I worked with him for quite a few years, of course, and knew him fairly well. I wouldn't say I was a close friend of his, but I certainly worked with him on a lot of different things.
Fred Harrington has talked about his position in the administration and how he got to it from the 1940s. And he was, I guess, still, or not as powerful toward the end of Fred's period. Is that right?
Are you talking about Peterson?
Peterson, yes.
Well, I don't know who Fred really relied on that much for his advice and counsel. He had Ira Baldwin was one of his people as well, of course. So I'm not sure who he really looked to for his inside advice.
I got the impression that he felt closer to Cafferty and maybe used them as counterweights to each other.
Could be possible, because Cafferty worked pretty closely with E.B. Fred on a lot of the details, and E.B. Fred could get very much into the details.
Oh.
And so that worked out very well.
The business office was reorganized in 1962.
Oh, we had a number of reorganizations, though, but none of them were all that radical, I would say.
This was something ordered by the Regents.
They were all done internally. No, we did it and would take it to the Regents if we're. There was some structuring. That was probably when Peterson pretty much removed himself from operations. I think it was we were almost strictly on buildings and trust funds at that time. But there wasn't that. It was an evolution of the people that were there, really.
You don't see that as a watershed period. And there were some title changes, I guess.
Yes, but that was, again, it really didn't change the operation that much. Oh. It really didn't. There wasn't any major, I wouldn't consider them major changes in the way we operated. There were some few title changes and a few official wording of responsibility changes, but they were already in place, really, and had evolved into being in place. And so it may appear to an outsider that there were some fairly significant changes, but they really weren't that.
I can't remember where I got that piece of information.
Well, there were some in the newspapers and this type of thing, and some in the Regent actions and this type of thing, laying out what the various things were, but it was really more of a documentation of what was already in place more than it was a revolutionary change.
And it wasn't that Harrington came in and said...
No, not really. The business office really didn't change much through all those administration, except as a gradual evolution, part of which had to take place because of the increase in size and volume and complexities. And see, Peterson was in charge of the building programs, and as that become more and more of a, the magnitude of it just increased a great deal, that became really almost a full-time job with him, and the trust fund portion of it. Clark Smith actually did a lot of the trust fund work for Peterson, even though he was secretary of the board. He did a lot of that work. But as far as the accounting of those were concerned, we did those in our office as long as I can remember when I first started. In fact, the first few months I was there, I was working on that. So it didn't change all that much. One of the other things about Harrington was that he had really planned that Milwaukee very quickly would become a mirror image of the Madison campus. with its particular thrust for the urban problems and urban, well, he wanted an architecture school, which they eventually got, and their whole set of problems relating to the urban sociology and so on. And he thought that should happen very quickly, and he arranged to have some of the Wharf annual grant go to Milwaukee. I think it was up to $500,000 a year they got for research. And see, Milwaukee was never a research institution until merger, and he was pushing very hard that they should become a major research institution. I think he envisioned it becoming a UCLA of Wisconsin. You know, there was Berkeley there, which was the old school, and then UCLA developed it. And that was really his vision. Then he looked upon Parkside and Green Bay campuses as the same way, that they too would be smaller, modern research institutions with their own missions. And Green Bay one, of course, environmentally oriented, but again would be a major research school eventually, and Parkside was related to science and industry, because coming out of the heavily industrial areas of Racine and Kenosha, mm-hmm. that seemed logical. And so Wiley was installed there as a chancellor, even though he was a historian, that this was what he was supposed to be doing, was going heavily into the science and industry area. And Widener was hired at Green Bay because of his strong interest in his attempts to establish a unique type institution with the stress on environment. They were anticipated that eventually they would become 20,000 student institutions. And of course, will never come to pass. I don't think that they will come anywhere near that. You know, they're 5,000 and 4,000 now, and we'll probably never go over 7,500 or something like that. But they have, in some respects, done more research than any of the other non-doctoral campuses have, but they're still, certainly you wouldn't rate them as major research institutions or even as minor research institutions. Research is pretty small part of their total effort there.
You handle their business affairs, is that right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right, so that... I've always been puzzled. How did you feel when you heard, you realized that Milwaukee and Parkside and Green Bay were being built up?
Well, you couldn't help but be optimistic. Hmm. As I mentioned earlier, the enrollment projections were very rosy during that time in the 60s, and their estimated enrollments for these institutions was based upon the Coordinating Council. CCHE for Wisconsin, on their estimates, really, because they had projected out by into the 80s, I don't know what the total enrollment in the state would be, but it'd be up well over 200,000. I'm sure it had to be, because Madison was in the 40,000 range, 40,000 to 45,000, and Milwaukee is probably pretty much where I think they were up around, projected around 27,500, but Green Bay, Parkside were way up, and a lot of the other institutions like Eau Claire and all that were much higher, and Superior was up at 5,000 at least, and they're at 2,000. So the enrollment pictures, which came out about 1968, were extremely optimistic. And then, of course, the birth rate, which had really started to go down in about 64, when it really started to go down, it continued to go down for a long time. So the bodies just aren't there, and probably won't ever be there because of the way the population is shifting, if anything, to the Sun Belt areas. And Wisconsin, at least for quite a while, is not going to see the big increase in the traditional college age students. But I would say that most of us in the business office were optimistic, and sure, we had some concerns and so on, whether it would really materialize anywhere near as rapidly as had been envisioned, but we did whatever we could to make happen what he wanted to happen. I think the putting research money into Milwaukee from Wharf, if it would have worked out, it would have been a good idea, because in turn they probably could have gotten, if they'd gotten the right scientists, they could have developed the right inventions, so they could have been putting money back into Wharf the same way that Madison had done. But the few inventions we've gotten from the outlying campuses, not many of them have been money makers. Now, Wharf does handle the patents for Stout or Oshkosh or anybody else as well. Mm-hmm. But there have been very few money makers coming in from those institutions.
Nobody, I've never talked to anybody about the move with which the central administration is split off from the Madison campus. I'm sure there must be a lot of literature on it in the archives, and I haven't happened to see it yet. But how much of a break was it?
Yeah, I was trying to think in the business area particularly how much of a break there was.
Well, there wouldn't have been any in the business office, because Madison didn't have its own business office.
That's right. It really wasn't much of a break at all. The real break, even though it took place some years before that when Harrington, was when Harrington moved to Van Hise. When he was still in Madison, there was a provost at Madison and provost at Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. But they really, Harrington still pretty much ran Madison, I think, when he was in Bascom Hall.
I see.
So I think a lot of the break really came when the move to Van Hise, which would have been 69. At that time, I think the chancellor of Madison then really...
You sure it wasn't 67? You mean it was after the... No, it has to have been 67, because the Dow riot was in 67.
Could have been. Could have been 67. I'm not sure.
I don't think Harrington was sitting in Bascom Hall during the...
I thought it was 69, but you could be right on that. I'm not sure. Hmm. But I thought we moved into Peterson Building in 64 and to Van Hise in 69, but I'm not going to guarantee that by any means. But anyway, I think that's when it was pretty clear cut from that time mm-hmm. on. But before that, it was always much fuzzier. But I think once they moved out of there and moved to Van Hise, it was perceived by everybody that there was a split. Then before that, maybe literature and the documentation, the split had taken place, but I think by many faculty and so on, it really wasn't perceived as a clean cut until the move actually went there. See, before that, there was Extension had been established separately, and Milwaukee had been brought in, so there was, going way back, well, in 56, Milwaukee was really brought in as a satellite. No, their graduate school, they didn't even have their own graduate school dean to start with, reported to the Madison graduate mm-hmm. school dean. No. So that was pretty much of a satellite campus until, I guess really when Extension was set up separately is when it was more of a split out of the system administration, the way Harrington envisioned it anyway, as being separate from having Madison run its own shop.
And did this affect you? You say it was perceived as a split. How did it? When he moved to Van Hise?
That wasn't, I was trying to think really, when the Madison business office really became more separate was really at the time of merger.
Yes.
71, really at the time of 71.
They were wanting it in 67, Fleming.
Yeah,
Fleming
right.
Did.
Right.
I don't think it really...
Right, yeah, because I know I had some words one time with Atwell because they thought they were completely independent. You know, we took everything to the Board of Regents, and he was fussing, and that could have been 67 or 6, yeah, right in that area. So
you mentioned Atwell. I'm very curious. He comes across as very, very intelligent and very aggressive, and his position. What did you think of him?
Well, he had some problems as a business administrator, I would say. And
explain that.
Well, I'm just trying to think the best way of saying it. That some respects more provincial and not seeing the total picture the way you would think that he would have seen it from with his background and training. Yeah. That he was not always willing to recognize the total picture.
By the total picture, you mean the whole
of the institution as a mm-hmm. total, and how they fit into the total hierarchy, going all the way up to the board. And it was a real almost inability to recognize that that role that he was playing and had to play in the total picture that did cause some friction and some problems with his business administration. He was very bright, no question about it, and I assume right now he's trying to become the president of the American Council of Education. So he's been the vice president of there. He has good experience. He's been at a major public institution, was president of a small private institution, and now has been there as vice president for a number of years. And I still see him every once in a while. We're still friends, but I would say that he really wasn't a real tower of strength in that administration.
Are you speaking from the point of view of the central administration, and
more so than from the
because somebody in the Madison campus and
departments may have looked at him differently.
Yes, and I confess I'm still very much oriented to the mm-hmm. Madison campus.
Oh, sure.
That is, most of the people mm-hmm. I talk to mm-hmm. are. So, would you say that he was very strong in the interests of Madison?
Some aspects of the Madison he would support very strongly. And I guess this was one other thing that, from our perspective at least, it wasn't necessarily an even-handed administration as far as the campus was concerned either.
Mm. Where was it?
Well, I'm just trying to think of which areas were more favored roles than others, but there were certain ones which I think was the impression we had anyway, that it was not exactly an even-handed administration.
Do you mean among the colleges?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I see.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that you mean Fleming would have favored some more than others?
Well, not Fleming. I was thinking of Atwell.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, I'm referring to Atwell now. Mm-hmm. That maybe the humanities would have been favored over the ag sciences or something like that, but I don't want to really say which way it went, but I mean, this was some of the impressions we had, that it was not really necessarily an even-handed administration going down, and the role playing going up created some problems with him.
Did you think of him as presumptuous?
Yeah, in some areas, yeah, particularly in his role playing on the way up.
Mm-hmm.
Or in the role he played, not in his role playing, but in the role he was expected to play on the way up. But he did very well on presentations to the board and certain issues and this type of thing. He was a very articulate person, no question about it, and hardworking. But everybody, nobody's perfect, So, he had some shortcomings like all of us do. So.
Is he at all, are he and Clodius at all similar? What sort of a person was Clodius? How did you see him?
No, I wouldn't say that they're. I wouldn't say that they were similar. No, mm-hmm. no.
They were both strong vice.
Yeah, but Atwell was more the business area, where Clodius really was the academic person, and he looked to the business office for the business function. And Atwell was brought in to be the business.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. He was the business office. Yeah. And I was trying to think the other day who the vice chancellor for. I know him and everything, and I went to California, and he's still in California, president of a smaller college in California now, was the vice chancellor for academic affairs. And I've forgotten what his name was anyway, but and see, Bob Atwell was either vice chancellor or assistant chancellor for business affairs. So the two, Clodius.
You'd be talking about so you didn't deal with Clodius very much?
Oh, I did when he was vice president, because he dealt with Caffrey and I a lot of times. Then he brought Wally Lemon in too, to be his assistant from state government. And a lot of times we had a lot of meetings with Clodius on budgets and this type of thing for our number of years there, that the four of us would sit around the table and really develop the budgets and the budget strategies and that type of thing. So I had a lot of dealings with Bob Clodius. Bob was a strong supporter of the humanities, particularly. He was and the fine arts. Mm-hmm. Great interest in fine arts. He tells the story how we bought more pianos than anybody else ever did at one time.
Oh yes, he has that mistake.
Where were they? Now I understand that most of them are becoming worn out. Need maintenance and replacement and so on.
Well, let's talk about computing. I mean, you were very involved in computing, isn't
it? Yeah, right? More so in the administrative data processing, administrative computing than I was in the academic computing. Of course, we did work with them in their financing arrangements and so on for the academic computing. Never really worked in the management of academic computing.
When did you first start thinking about the fact that computing and how it was done was going to be a problem that had to be dealt with?
Well, when I came to work in 1947, we were on punch card system at that time for much of our accounting. And we were, George Sheeler, who started shortly before I did, I think the year before I did, was brought in to computerize the payroll system at that time. Right? That goes way back to 1946. So. Administratively, we've had computing going on for a long, long time in the business office. Mm-hmm. And then it expanded, kept growing all the time, because both Caffrey and myself felt that you had to be current in computing to stay ahead in the area of business. So we were always worked with IBM and quite closely in the newest innovations and so on that would come out in the computing. And so historically we were always in the forefront of colleges and universities around the country and what the applications we had in the computing area for the business operation.
Why IBM?
Because IBM was by far the leader in the field for many, many years, of course. And this was before the days of CDC and some of the rest, and Burroughs were still with their more or less bookkeeping machines, and NCRs with bookkeeping machines, and IBM had almost a monopoly in the business operation computers at that time, did for years.
This is tape 4 of the interview with Ruben Lorenz. You rented an IBM for a long time. Who made that decision?
To rent or buy?
Yeah.
We made the decision in the business office whether to rent or buy, and it was our feeling that your computing equipment became obsolete so fast that you would be better off to rent it and stay current, then you could move to the next generation much easier. Whereas if you'd buy it, you'd have that big capital outlay, which you'd have to somehow or other find the money for a capital outlay at one time, and then in 3, 5, 7 years, you'd have to again go out and find that similar outlay for a new generation computer, and that was very difficult to do the way the state finances and university finances are structured. So we always felt that it was to our advantage to be leasing rather than buying. And I think that was a good decision. I think those were the right decisions that were made at that time.
So the CDC what does CDC stand for?
Controlled Data Corporation.
Yeah.
Yeah, controlled
that. That was for academic.
That's correct. That was for academic, and then they also had some big, powerful Burroughs machines for academic computing. And see, some of those machines were more oriented to scientific work and this type of thing, which lent themselves better to, or as well, I should say, to academic computing as anything that IBM had, and they were willing to get some very substantial discounts for the people who used their equipment.
So you had nothing to do with the decision?
No, they had experts come in and really do the work on those things. And I remember Merv Muller was very much involved in some of their acquisitions. I think that was the CDC, I think, that he developed the specifications for that, and he was much more conversant in all of the intricacies of a scientific computing needs and so on than anybody in our office was. We stayed with the business applications of it, the payroll, accounting, that type of thing.
So you didn't concern yourself with what was happening over there at that time?
Only to the effect of how they were going to be financed and paid for and this type of thing. And it was much later where the administration of the two were pretty much combined as they now are. But even so, the hardware are still completely separate between administrative computing and the academic computing.
Do you remember the Expand Committee?
Expand?
I think it was called that. You had an IBM man and the hospital and the business office. You formed a committee.
Oh! This was where this is where we were trying to go, I think, online, online with a number of installations, which again we were at that particular time we were ahead of our time. See, now everything, we were trying to hook up into the first IBM 360s, which had remote possibilities with them. But the top administration and some of the deans and so on weren't ready to accept it at that particular time. So we ran into some roadblocks of moving as rapidly as we could have.
Who was not ready, willing to accept it?
Well, I think two of them that weren't ready were Don Percy and Irv Shane.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, isn't it though?
Yeah.
And part of it's the way it was marketed. Ted Wheezy was really the person we had in administrative data processing at that time, and he had an overly aggressive approach to things, and it wasn't a soft sell, and he just turned these people off, and in some respects he knew more about what he was trying to do than they did, and they didn't like that either, so he just turned them off on it, and so. Couldn't, you know, until you had support from those particular people, well, you just couldn't move on it. So it was sidetracked. Of course, now everything is all computerized and much more than that, but it could have been done probably 5 years sooner than it was.
So was this his idea, would you say?
Well, yeah, he and I worked very closely on that, and he worked with, we had all the stuff from IBM and this type of thing and the other manufacturers and so on, so we talked about it, and they looked like great ideas and so on. So I'd give him credit for most of the initiation of the ideas, but we kicked him around a lot, and it would have been the way to go.
So if you had presented it, you mean you might have gotten it?
Well, I don't know. I'm not saying that, but as I say, we're probably a little before our time, and the sales techniques we used weren't the greatest. I'm not blaming Ted for it completely, but I recognize that he did turn off these people.
He strikes me, as I see the memos he wrote to people in the files, mm-hmm. as a kind of a Madison Avenue type, but somebody who had elaborate flow charts and long descriptions of things.
Exactly, yeah, exactly.
It seemed rather superfluous.
But it just wasn't the technique that was working at that time. Yeah. So I think that was unfortunate. I don't think it did any great harm or anything like that, but I think we could have been 3, 4, 5 years ahead of where we were in developing some of the things that have eventually come to pass now. So. He was right up in the cutting edge of everything that was coming out and available all the time. So
you think he was a good man?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was good.
He understood computing.
Oh, yeah, no question about it, yeah. Yeah, I think that, but he was one of those, again, you had to keep some reins on him, and on that particular one, maybe I should have held him back a little longer, made him go a little slower on it, and maybe it would have been halfway in between where we are now and the way it could have happened. He's a consultant now out of Houston, Texas, doing very well.
Well, there's a memo in the files. I'd like to show it to you. It's not signed. There was an extra copy. I guess I made it. This is dated November 1966.
Yeah, see, this is one of the reasons that it didn't fly, because the campuses wouldn't go for, even I think you saw campuses and colleges would have their own reporting to their own area, rather than having it all linked together. And this was the age-old problem of campus autonomy.
Yeah.
And this sounds like Atwell. Yeah, it sounds like an Atwell letter. And that's the type of language that he would use and so on. Very jealous of protecting everything. So. And see, the data processing eventually went to Madison.
But there was great concern about the merging of the two. There's a memo from Bach to Shane in which he says he can't get information he needs for graduate school from either of them, mm-hmm. the UADP or the ADP, and he has to have friends in both who will out the back door slip him what he needs. Were you aware of this?
Well, I knew there were some information they couldn't get, and that. But I didn't realize that he had to go that circuitous route to get it. Anything we had was available to anybody, of course.
You say that. Do you really? I've heard that elsewhere too.
Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't be surprised that you probably had somebody who wouldn't give it out. The data processing people are their own breed, and they're very jealous of what they develop and program and this type of thing. As you can see from here, there was Madison had its. We still got the problem of getting things out of Madison. I did have it before, not now. I guess I do right now too. We're trying to get something from now. We can't get it. But the campus and the input from some of the areas would be so guarded. And if you don't have the database, you can't produce any reports which have that type of information in them. So it's a matter of accumulating a database. And this was an age-old problem that we went through as long as I was ever connected with the university, of trying to develop databases which would be as comprehensive as you would like them, so that you could generate the reports later on. And part of it was a matter of protecting their own turf by some of the campuses. In some cases it's personnel people. When you're looking for personnel information, the personnel people are reluctant to release certain things that go into a database which may be used, they feel may be used in some ways.
Or is it that they work so hard to accumulate this that if somebody else incorporates it into their own records?
Then their job is, sometimes I think they envision that their job might be in jeopardy because they're no longer the sole source of information.
Yeah, well, would that be a reason?
Well, that's part of it. That's not uncommon, you know, in any area, that you want to make yourself indispensable. That's not the only reason, probably, but I think it's always either their job or their department or something will no longer be an essential part of the organization if you take this whole thing and move it someplace else. Part of the area, one of the real problems in the whole data processing area of getting a unified, broad system, database for the system, the fact that the computing was shifted to Madison because Madison had most of the need for it, most of the resources and that type of thing. But then it could not be expanded really to accommodate other campus needs to the extent that would have been economically wise. Shane in particular felt over all the years that if that was to be released at all, that the other institutions would put demands upon data processing, which would have to be funded from the Madison operating budget. And besides that, that demands would be coming in which their program people and analysts would have to look at and take time to do it, which may not be 100% consistent with the Madison campus management philosophy, principles, so on. That it would be an intrusion into the what he felt was the Madison campus administration. So it was not only the funding, but it was the administration as well. Now, of course, the computers have become so sophisticated in measuring work units and to charge out work units that that's not as much of a problem as it was 7, 5, 7, 8 years ago. And so I think there's a little more feeling of potential possibility and so on of doing more consolidating now than there has been before. But that has been a real problem. I think the system would have been better off if they could have had a single high-powered administrative data processing system.
This is the utility concept.
That's
right?
Correct. That's correct. A time sharing, whatever you want to call it, the utility, chargebacks, and all of those things that go along with it would have been the most efficient route to go. But the internal politics were such that that just couldn't be pulled off.
It was very much talked about, though.
Oh, it's been, well, not as much the last...
I'm talking about the 60s.
It was, and it, right up until the time of merger. And see, Milwaukee was debating whether they should have their own or whether they should hook on. At that time, it was the data processing run by the system, up until just about time of merger, until I think maybe shortly before it was turned over, but right up about that time anyway. And did cost analysis with Milwaukee, whether they'd be had to go separately or stay tied in with, and it was definitely more economical to stay tied in with Madison, or with the system at that time. But see, Madison wasn't really willing to go all the way on their having a dean tie into system administration with a remote output. See, well, see, the hardware and the main operational run by what was in system, our office, was running the computer. But the Madison Chancellor's office wouldn't allow the dean of LNS, say, to have a direct line.
To Milwaukee?
Into the system computer. That's what that the memo. That's what that memo is talking about there.
I see.
And so.
Into the.
So they wanted it to report to the chancellor. See, anything like that had to report to the chancellor.
Huh.
So that was part of the problem.
But that has now they can, LNS can.
Well, now, see that around 1970, it was shifted over to the Madison campus. So Madison campus controls that computer, and then system administration also has its own computing center, which do a lot of the same things.
Oh,
so,
yeah, okay.
So it would be much better if their
which
is located out in the wharf. It would be much better if it was all tied into one, more economical. See, the Madison does the work for Green Bay, Parkside, Extension, Center System, and Milwaukee. And they could do it for the other institutions now with the sophistication of the machines and when, and could be out and build out whatever work they do and this type of thing. And we would have one single interface with the state government and all of the daily reports would have to go down there and everything like that. That'd be a better operation. But the internal politics was such that you couldn't do it. It hasn't been a great hardship not to do it that way, but if some outside consultant come in, and I'm sure they would recommend that there be one utility concept doing the work for everybody, the way it would be looked upon, I'm sure.
Oh.
So sometimes people get in the way of what is the best thing to do. But,
nearly always. when Percy put a freeze on purchasing of computers, do you remember that?
Yeah.
It was in 1970, I guess. And this is, again, the academic. And the Milwaukee.
No, it was the Milwaukee administrative as well.
Who threatened to resign.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he said that's right. He said UADP was getting a new machine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what? Wasn't that against the rules? Why did you?
Oh, it's a bad rule.
I see. A bad rule.
It really was. It was a bad rule. And they had to back off from it, of course. They had to back off from it. But it was not.
His notion was, until we've thought this out clearly, we're not going to spend any money.
And in the meantime, the world goes on, see.
Yeah.
And that particular group met for several years without doing anything. I met with them.
Guidance Committee?
Yeah. And I met with them several times. You know, it was an impossible committee to get in.
Well, was that Engman and?
I don't know if he was on it or not. Somebody from Milwaukee was on it. I remember the times I met with it. And, it was a combination of administrative and academic, mostly academic people in it. People from student records as well as from the business area.
I see. So it couldn't get anything done because everybody had different interests.
Yeah, they all had their own axe to grind. And, over the years, it's been some continuation of somewhat of a similar type operation, which had become, I think, semi-successful over the years.
Is this the Computer Services Committee?
It's had a whole different group of names, and it's got a new one, and it's still in existence, but it has a different name today again.
This is it. Well, I don't know what it is, but in 1970, Clodius writes to a number of people, which include Extension and UW-Milwaukee and UW-Green Bay and says, at the request of Mr. Ruben Lorenz, I am appointing you to an ad hoc committee on computer financing.
No, that was a different, that's a different one, yeah.
But is that the same kind of group?
No, because this one limited itself strictly to administrative one. That was a different group.
So why was Percy, who seems to have been a...
Well, an awful lot of money was being spent on computing.
Hmm.
And nobody was particularly happy, I guess, with the structure, because people thought they didn't have enough say in the management of it, or the management people didn't have enough concern for the users. So it was everybody likes a hands-on computer anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been true as long as I can remember that.
Like driving your own car.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's even though it may be more costly, that people think they can be more effective, and it's a hands-on situation.
Well, who was the best person in the administration for understanding what had, you say Percy, in a way, would have held it back?
Well, that was part of the problem. There wasn't any one person who had the total picture. Because the student records historically were pretty much separated from the business records. And that was true on every, in Milwaukee as well as in Madison, mm-hmm. just about every campus. And so you...
Well, that's the registrar.
Right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so again, you always had the difference of opinion even there, which should get priority during registration week. Do you pay the payroll, or do you... register students, and
yeah.
So you had problems there. So, and you never did get any one person who was the czar of all administrative computing, even at that time, to be totally familiar with both of those ends of it. And that was one of the problems of it, I think. But I think you look at Madison now. Madison is just so far behind on their registration of students, you know, that it's pathetic. You know, they should have been doing this 20 years ago.
They were talking about it 20
right,
years ago.
Right, yeah, and that's why I say that they should have been doing
but
it then.
Whose fault is that?
Well, I don't know whose fault it is, but it's the fact of really the top administration not giving it a high priority.
Hmm.
I think you have to look at the top administration of not of setting their priorities, and that hasn't been one of their top priorities. No, I still think that if somebody like Ted would have been allowed a little more running room and getting more support from some of the people, that a lot of things that should have been done would have been done, and medicine registration would have been a heck of a lot more computerized than it is today, and Milwaukee, which is just now doing things that we said they should have done 15 years ago in various areas, and would have been done. But, I guess the chancellors, I think, have a lot of blame for it. And again, maybe this is understandable because their primary interest was in the academic area.
And they say, well, the students just have to run around.
That's not that bad for having them run around and this type of thing. They only have to do it a couple times a year, and so we'll continue to do it manually, which mm-hmm. is basically a manual operation. Other major schools all over the country are doing it all electronically.
Accounts of the contracts. And yet, Ted, when the offices finally were joined, he left or was out a couple of months later.
Or earlier.
Did he resign, or was he fired?
Well, he was really removed from administrative position. See, when it shifted to Madison, they didn't want any part of him.
Uh-huh.
See, that's why I say he and Irv Shane just didn't hit it off. Irv didn't put him in that position. So he was really out for some time before that, as far as the direct administration was concerned.
which you think was a mistake.
Yeah, he had vision. He had vision. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jack Dewey is a very good person in there too. No question about it. The current head of ADP is very good.
And what about Catter?
Who?
Did you know him?
Catter?
Yes, Dennis Catter. He was the head of the Madison.
Dennis was not easy to work with. But again, if they would have given Dennis support, he could have done a lot of things which he, again, was not allowed to do. Because he had some pretty good ideas too, I think, that should have been done. But he didn't get administrative support. He did for a little while, but not very long.
You were in on the whole UWCC computing center, which erupted finally in 1970, and Mervyn Muller, who resigned. I mean, you're on committees. And
yeah.
Do you remember that?
I worked on more on the financing end of it than mm-hmm. anything. And also whether, I think on the periphery, there were some questions whether they should absorb the whole administrative one and this type of thing. That was one. Those were, I assume, the two reasons that I was on it, to look at that aspect of it and then also the financing of it. But I think we always worked out financing to reasonably good ways. And we've got a lot of different ways of laundering money to get it purchased. And we used third parties, and we've leased it, and we've purchased it, and we've borrowed money and everything like this. We've done everything imaginable to get it. But they've always had the equipment and that they wanted, really.
Well, Percy wrote a memo on, he had looked into the situation at the computing center and said essentially they had never run on a budget, and they were always way over.
It was, but the graduates, part of their budget was a plan to support it from the graduate school. Graduate school always put money into the computing mm-hmm. center. And part of it was planned and part of it was not properly reflected in the graduate school budget. And then the last year's the...
Well, the implication is that Mervyn Muller was not a good manager.
No.
Is that mm-hmm. right? What was your opinion of it?
Well, I guess I wouldn't say he wasn't a good manager in some respects. I think he did. He was an expansionist, and he probably spent more money than a lot of people thought he should. But on the other hand, he did bring along their academic computing at a pretty good rate. So. And he did drive some very hard bargains in getting the equipment in at good prices. He had some very strong points that I say he did operate maybe a little free and loose with the dollar sometimes, but nothing that graduate school couldn't bail him out of or anything like that. And I think he was aware of what his situation was. But
in what way was he out? He left in 1970.
Yeah, he went to Princeton, I believe, didn't he?
Did you see it as a resignation or as a being dumped?
I guess it was partly a mutual agreement that it would be best for all parties if he went someplace else. So, so it was, I don't think he would have been forced to resign if he hadn't. But he saw this other opportunity, and I think that the university felt that they weren't too unhappy to see him leave.
Do you have anything to do with Stefferud? Remember, he came and did a survey of the whole thing?
No, I remember coming in and doing a survey, but I really don't remember any of the details.
Because that was the academic.
Yeah. And I think I was provided a copy of it, but I don't remember the details of it at all.
I think you wrote a memo once expressing concern at the fact that nothing really had been done about instructional computing and about financing it during the 60s.
Yeah,
do
that's probably
that?
True, because, again, this is probably one of the reasons that Irv Muller was running deficits, because he was providing a lot of support for the instructional departments without any real logical plan for billing the departments for it and for getting reimbursed for all the energy that they put into it. We had proposed a number of different options on that, that they actually bill the departments for it, or that there be a allocation to the computing center, which was set aside for instructional computing, and then in their own internal ways they would bill that particular allocation for the instructional work. But so it was kind of really for a number of years there was just a hit and miss proposition. Mm-hmm. And they probably charged some departments for it, or if they did research they charged them for it, and they wouldn't charge them for instruction. And so it wasn't a well thought through program in their budgeting or in their execution. I'm not sure how they're doing it right now either. Not that close to it. But anyway, they're on a solvent basis now anyway. So.
It seems to me that, I'm not sure whether you said this or whether other places like Princeton and Columbia were, the aim was perhaps just to make it free to do instructional computing, so you wouldn't charge for it. It would be just one of the services, like rooms.
Right, yeah.
But that,
that was... That's where you would have an allocation for it. Somebody's got to pick up the tab for it.
Yes.
And so you have an allocation to the department, that is the computing science department, so you don't bill sociology or economics for the work you do for them, but you go ahead and do it, but then mm-hmm. you bill this other department for it. Or the other one is that you make an allocation to the various departments, such as economics, and then you bill them for it. But, Princeton charged all of theirs an indirect cost rate. And then, of course, they got the money back through from the General University resources, from which the indirect cost rate went into, and then they got the money back that way. And that drove their indirect cost rate up to over 90%, which was frowned upon by everybody from congressmen to program administrators in Washington. And, so they had to go back the other way out now and direct charge it out. And actually, they forced upon all of the institutions a direct charge basis on it. Because,
well, that's another one of the computer issues is mm-hmm. how it was figured into grants. Mm-hmm. And you were concerned in that.
Right, yeah.
Was because that important?
You can only charge grants what you charge other people. Mm. And so you had to set up some basis that the grants would only pay their pro rata share of what the costs of the department were. So you had to develop a cost basis and figuring that out and justifying. You still have to do that every year. Have to file a report of the computing center charges with the federal auditors. That has to be done every year and mm-hmm. justify it. So that was essential, yes, to develop some cost basis. So that has been taken care of.
Well, we've been talking about a lot about computing. How large did it loom in your workload over that period? How important did you think it?
Oh, I don't think it. It was just another one of the aspects that I don't look back upon it as being a particularly troublesome or onerous area any more so than a lot of other things, such as budgets and this type of thing. And, it was one of those things you continually worked on to try and solve, and knowing that you're never going to solve it to everybody's satisfaction. But, it's an area where it was a fast-growing area, and with as many alternatives as you had people involved in the discussion. So I don't look upon it in retrospect that it was all that bad, I guess. It was better than most people thought it was. We could have done a lot more in the last 15 years in the administrative area than we're done. We were doing an adequate job and better than most places are doing on it, so it wasn't a real major problem in that respect.
I see. because when you do, the files are very thick.
Yes.
The letter's very cranky sometimes.
And Oh, yeah, there were a lot of heated discussions and so on, but if you look at some other subject, you'd probably find the same thing, the files up there, with some heated discussion. Probably not as many as with computing, because that was, almost everybody's affected by computing.
Mm.
Whether you're in the business area, in the student records area, or and now in the academic area, everybody's affected by it, so it's bound to be thicker file than some other issues are. But, it was very frustrating at times, no question about it. And you'd get stymied from areas you wouldn't think you'd get stymied from. But we were a leader in it around the country for many years. And we're still probably able to do more analytical work and costing and this type of thing than most schools can do, so we're not all that bad off. But could be done more, somewhat more effectively and efficiently than it is being done.
How about patents? How important were they, the issues having to do with patents?
Well, patents are so isolated that it affects very, very few people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you get a Carl Paul Link and you get a Hector DeLuca and a few people like that, it is very, very important to them. But we don't have that many people who have inventions, you know. What was our friend from chemistry who had gotten the argument with Henry Guckel on this one on patents and became very messy situation, a very nasty situation. But patents affect very few people, really.
But the patent having to do with Charles Heidelberger's discovery was a real problem for the university.
That's right. That's
Were
right.
you at all involved in
that? I got in on it in the late stages of it, and Bill Young and I did make some trips to Washington and to try and continue to mend fences after mm-hmm. that one. And that was where there was a, and the federal government was really petty on that one.
Oh.
Because he'd used just a very minuscule amount of supplies which had been purchased from a federal grant in the development of 5FU. And most of the support came from the university either through WARF or tax funds and through La Roche, I believe it was. I think it was one pharmaceutical.
That's the company.
One pharmaceutical house anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And it put most of the money into it, and there was probably, you know, like 0.1% of the money came from the federal government, but yet they insisted that they get patent rights on it. Mm-hmm. And of course, the agreement with NIH says if they have funding it, why then they had rights on it.
The Public Health Service.
Yeah.
Is that part of NIH?
NIH is part of Public Health Service.
Ah.
Yeah, the other way around.
Yeah.
Of course, NIH, Public Health Service,
yeah.
And then the department on top of that. So, yes, we, Bill Young and I did make some trips to Washington and that, and so Charlie Brown and trying to think of the other fellow in Public Health Service, their attorneys and so on. So, and I'm not even sure exactly how it was finally resolved on it, but I guess the government got a royalty-free license or something like that on it. And,
I see. So you don't think, you don't think that the university looked bad in this and
No, they really, really, on that particular one, it was very petty on the part of the federal government, but on the other hand, there was a contract there.
Mm.
And even if it was only $70 or $107, I forget what it was, but it was some amount about that magnitude,
mm-hmm.
we were in violation. And so, we needed to carry it to the extreme, you know, but on a realistic basis, why we really weren't that much at fault on the thing, but if you carry it to the final point of the contract, we were in violation. So we had to backtrack and pick up the pieces on it and go all the way back and then try and set up a mechanism which would go forward without making those. So we got We got the first National Science Foundation patent agreement, institutional agreement. We were number one in that, and we were, I don't know if we were the first one from Public Health Service, but we were one of their very first ones too for an institutional type agreement with them and how patents should be handled. Charlie Brown in both places, both Public Health Service and the National Science Foundation.
I hope he was good to deal with.
They were both good to deal with. The other fellow in Public Health Service was Manny somebody, and I've forgotten what his last name is now. He was Tupper. He was head of their legal staff, but he was tougher to deal with. But now I think we have an excellent working relationship with WARF, and we try and have enough checks and balances in the situation so that that won't happen again. Some patents become very sticky, you know, particularly with the Department of Interior. They were one that we went on for years and years and years trying to resolve, just trying to get them to make a decision, and they just won't make a decision on it. Department of Commerce is another one that they've been very tough to work with. Public Health Service and National Science Foundation have been very easy. No problem with them at all. So we report to them, and we have to report every year what you're doing on all of them, how much you're spending, and how much you're getting. But that WARF does all that work for us now. But we've worked out a system on that. It's only when you get some sticky ones where you have multiple sources of support that they become time-consuming. We did it when I was there. We did all the relationships with WARF and that, and feds on it. Well, we turned that back to the Madison Graduate School shortly before I left. We felt that since almost all of the activity was at Madison, that they should take care of the Madison ones, and from the other institutions, where the system administration would work on that one. But that was kind of a fun one. That was kind of a fun aspect of the job because it was so different, you know, and you found out what some of the new thinking was in the various areas, like some of Henry Guckel's and the person in chemistry of the spark, which was used for welding, and DeLucas were always so technical and your chemistry majors would be more interesting, and I don't know that much about chemistry. I'm sure they would be more interesting, but some of the others were very interesting things. And Roger Boom in engineering with some of his on separating metals, and also the ones on the energy storage, and some of those were very interesting to work with anyway. And the time element really wasn't that great, but so I always enjoyed that end of it because it was an interesting aspect, which wasn't all that troublesome. I went to Washington with Ray Herb, you know, and some of his that he had.
So you'd actually travel with the discoverer.
We always came out with a good working arrangement with it. And went out to Howard Bremer, and I went out to Boston Lawrence Hanscom Field to meet with the Air Force people out there. I know, and one some that we had out there. And so. Yeah. Were able to solve them without any real problems. So.
We'll conclude that for now at least.